This is Here's How, Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast, presented by William Campbell.
Thank you for downloading episode 98 of Here's How for the 23rd of January 2020. Ireland has been divided for a century, but opinion polls in the north suggest that may not last for much longer. In this podcast, I talk to someone who thinks we should be preparing.
Here's How is Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast. Make your view heard. Just dial 076 603 5060 and tell the world what you're thinking. Your voicemail may be included in the next podcast. You can find tips on recording your contribution and other ways to contact the show at hereshow.ie/call.
In a few minutes we'll have this.
Nobody wants to disrespect unionists and loyalists in this, this conversation. And one way that you disrespect unionists and loyalists is not treating people like unionists and loyalists. That people believe that the United Kingdom should continue in its current form are perfectly entitled to that view.
That's coming up shortly, but first I want to thank all of my donors on Patreon. I appreciate everyone who does that. Patreon is basically a system that allows people to donate a dollar or two per podcast or per month, and that helps me to devote more time to research and to finding interesting guests. If you could do the same as them, there's details on the website and at the end of the show. Following on from what I was saying at the top of the last podcast, I got in a couple of Twitter debates. I won't say Twitter spats, it was all very polite. I'll link to the threads on the website. But I got in a couple of Twitter debates during the week. It was about housing, building and planning policies. People are, rightly, very annoyed when they see homelessness all around them and derelict buildings, empty houses and prime sites that lie empty for decades. The thing is that, as with almost every problem, there is a quick, simple, easy to understand solution that is completely wrong. In this case, the two quick, simple, easy and completely wrong solutions are rent controls and using compulsory purchase orders, CPOs, to forcibly buy empty properties and house homeless people in them. The first thing to say here is that I don't doubt for a moment the good faith of the people who I was disagreeing with. I'm certain that they're motivated by nothing but a desire to help their fellow citizens. But let's take those ideas in order. The Swedish economist Assar Lindbeck said, "Next to bombing, rent controls are the most efficient known technique for destroying cities." What he meant was that, like with any product, if you artificially lower the price, then the producers respond by just stopping the production of that product. Why should they invest over here when the government forces them to give that product away below its market value when they can invest over there and make more money? Most people will see the flaw in that argument. Even if it's true that rent controls lead to dereliction, that is treating housing like just another commodity, like lawnmower widgets. But housing is much more important than that, and we can't do with a shortage of housing in the way that we could probably manage with a shortage of lawnmower widgets. And I agree, housing is different. It's not just a product, and that means we'll probably need special rules to deal with it. But just because we have special rules, that doesn't mean that people won't still act in their own rational best interests. Everyone will still try to get the best housing they can for the best price, and developers and landlords will still try to get the most profit from their investments. At the moment, we have a serious lack of suitable housing, and that's causing rents that are high and rising. But the problem is that rents are a method of rationing. Rent controls might or might not keep rents down, but they don't produce any extra supply. So if you have 100 houses needed in an area with only 90 houses, rent control or no rent control, you're 10 houses short. Rent controls might protect the 90 people who do get the houses from being exploited, but it does nothing for the 10 people who don't. But the real question is, what happens next? People like Assar Lindbeck would say that there is no incentive to build more housing for those 10 if the government just orders developers to make no profit, or at least a lower profit than if they built elsewhere. And it's worth remembering that those 10 are the poorest and the most vulnerable to begin with. But we're in a time of crisis. Mightn't rent controls get us through that crisis, at least give us some short-term relief? Well, they might, but at the cost of a lot of long-term damage. Let's look at the current situation. I wrote a book more than 10 years ago that talked about how almost all, more than 80% of the building land around Dublin was controlled by 8 individuals, just 8. That piece was based on an article written more than 10 years before that, and 20 years later, the situation has not changed. It's got worse, if anything. These individuals are sitting on that land. They can use it as equity to borrow against and invest elsewhere and make themselves even richer. And they drip feed the housing market with land at astronomical prices, making themselves even richer again. The great majority of their holdings they sit on, and they'd be crazy to do anything else. If they sold more than a tiny amount, they would massively deflate the price of the rest of their land banks. And they don't pay a cent in tax on this vast wealth. They are behaving perfectly rationally. It's our tax laws that are irrational. And believe me, that's no accident. These are hugely rich and influential people who are able to bend the ears and twist the arms of governments to make sure that those tax laws stay just the way that suits them. Now, let's add on to that political lobby another political lobby, the people who benefit from rent controls. They're renting at way below the market rate. That's worth cash in their pockets. This might start out benefiting normal people, but experience in places like New York shows that it's quickly a benefit that concentrates on people who are really quite wealthy. It's people who are looking for a new lease at market rates who pay the price. And the old money defends that privilege fiercely, opposing any development that would diminish their advantage by building enough for everyone. Put them alongside the land hoarders, and that's a powerful political force. Or you could go the way of Berlin, which is trying to force rent controls on all leases, new and old. Berlin is a very thinly populated city. It has a fraction of the population density of Paris, but it's Berlin that has the housing crisis, almost as bad as Ireland. And when they're trying to deal with it by using rent controls, they really mean business. The city government has a special department of detectives to try and find and close down apartments let on Airbnb. They've tried not only to keep rents from increasing, but also tried to give themselves the power to order existing rental contract prices to be lowered, and to set the rents in newly built apartment blocks. Some areas of Berlin even have regulations about exactly how you can renovate an apartment. You can put tiles in your bathroom, but only if they're ceramic tiles. Marble tiles aren't allowed because that would make it a luxury apartment and put upward pressure on the surrounding rents. They're basically bringing in new laws every year in a whack-a-mole way to try to prevent the housing market from functioning. The result is that there is kilometre after kilometre of vacant land in the city, very little building going on, and a huge housing crisis. The second issue that I commented on Twitter was an idea that we should use compulsory purchase orders, CPOs, to seize vacant properties to house people. This is well motivated, but it's a bad idea. It's a bad idea mostly because there is a better way of doing things. The way to do this is to tax property. Ireland is the only developed country that doesn't have a serious property tax. We focus all our taxes on income and economic activity. Economic inactivity gets away scot-free. There are huge tranches of vacant building land, derelict buildings, brownfield sites, and those huge land banks. and people are sitting on them tax-free. Their value is provided by the amenities that society builds around them, but they suck the lifeblood and the value out of anything that they're near. The simple solution is use it or lose it. Tax unused and underused land, vacant buildings and empty houses. As soon as the owners realise that they're costing them money, not making them money, you can be sure that they will release them onto the market. That extra supply will home the homeless and drive down prices for everyone. Why is that better than CPO? Here's why. CPO is a difficult, slow, expensive and cumbersome system. It has to be. You have to protect people's rights. And if you don't, you'll find yourself in court pretty quick. And they have to be compensated. And that means compensated at the prices of the crazy expensive market rate that we have now. And there's a huge systemic problem. You have to create a bureaucracy that decides what properties to CPO and how much to pay for them. When you create a system where public servants of ordinary means are making decisions that can make or cost very rich people many millions, it's hopelessly naive to imagine that money will not circle around and, one way or another, influence the public servants who are making the decision. Taxes, on the other hand, are brutally simple. You make X amount of money, you pay Y amount of income tax. You have X square meters of vacant land, you pay Y amount of vacancy tax. It's simple maths, and nothing is incorruptible, but maths is significantly less corruptible than woolly decisions made for soft, immeasurable reasons that just happen to benefit a very generous people. The problem here is that nobody likes new taxes, but sometimes we need them. The real irony is that parties like People Before Profit, supposedly a very left-wing outfit, voted to prevent our very modest property tax in the first place, and are now fighting like cats and dogs on local councils to keep it as low as possible, even though this means cutting services like libraries so they can give big tax cuts to landlords and millionaires in the swankiest part of town, while renters get nothing. That's the real problem. Ireland is a small country. No matter what the party, the temptation to cut soft decisions in favour of your crowd is just too great. That's why we need cold, hard, mathematically calculated decisions, not sending out a public servant to decide whether his brother-in-law's friend's house should be CPO'd or whether his bathroom tiles are acceptable.
Do you agree? Do you disagree? If you want your point of view heard, dial 076-603-5060 and leave a contribution for the show. The lines are open 24/7 and you can find tips on how to record a good contribution and other ways to contact the podcast at hereshow.ie/call.
Colin Harvey is Professor of Human Rights Law in the School of Law at Queen's University Belfast. He's a Fellow of the Senator George J. Mitchell Institute for Global Peace, Security and Justice, and he's an Associate Fellow of the Institute of Irish Studies. He has a list of academic qualifications and publications that are far too long to read out in the whole of the podcast, but I'm talking to him because he's involved with a group called Ireland's Future, which late last year wrote a letter to the Taoiseach with more than 1,000 signatories from people in the academic, arts, business, education, health, labour, law, media and sports sectors from around Ireland. Colin, can you tell me what was the letter asking?
Well, thank you very much. I think, first of all, important to put the letter in its wider context. Mm-hmm. Obviously, people will be aware that Brexit has fundamentally altered the nature of the conversation on the island, the constitutional conversation, mm-hmm. being taken out of the European Union, essentially in the north against our will, with external border of the European Union on the island. You know, the border becomes an external border of the European mm-hmm. Union, a feeling that rights and equality issues were going to be eroded. And I think a real anxiety particularly among Irish citizens in the north, that they were about to be abandoned and left behind again. So the letters really were an attempt to, particularly focused on the Irish government, to remind the Irish government of its responsibilities, to highlight the equality and rights crisis really looming with Brexit, and I suppose also now to underline the fact that Brexit raises the question around the constitutional future of this island. Obviously, the European Union now has made clear that if there is a vote for Irish reunification, that will mean automatic return to the European Union. So I think what the letters have focused initially on the rights and equality crisis, but as you'll know now, there's a focus on planning and preparing for the constitutional future. And in the latest interaction, the Ireland's Future Group has been has tried to stress really that there's a need for an all-Ireland citizens assembly to do the work of planning and preparation for constitutional change on the island as a matter of prudential planning. But I think it's important when thinking about Ireland's future that it's just one of a range of civic and other initiatives that have really arisen around Brexit and what that means for the future of our shared island.
Okay, first question there. You had about 1,000 signatories from all over the country, north and south. How many unionists signed the letter?
I think there's a sense in which there's a number of groups and organisations and others involved in the island and a growing civic conversation. And I think really what I'd like to underline
today is
Ireland's future is really one part of that wider conversation. There's civic and unionist initiatives and other things going on as well. So I think there's a sense in which Ireland's future is a very specific initiative, particularly relating to some of the points I've outlined there, among a range of initiatives. And you'll know, for example, that people like Peter Robinson and others have made public interventions in the debate around that. So I think, you know, to me, anyway, looking in on this, there's a sense in which there's a growing civic conversation involving a range of actors and a range of groups, of which Ireland's Future is just one discrete initiative, talking about, you know, how we're going to share this island in the future. And I think ultimately for me, it's good to see that collective civic conversation evolving. And really all I would say today is, look, just encourage everyone, whatever their constitutional position and background, to join in the conversation about where we're all heading.
I think that's a long way of saying that there weren't any unionists signing. But just for people who perhaps aren't 100% up to speed, as I understand it, you are looking for a citizens' assembly essentially along the lines of the ones that went before the marriage equality referendum and the repeal of the eighth referendum and some of the referendums, perhaps to a lesser degree, in the south, in order to tease out the issues and to allow those issues to be fully discussed before a vote happens. Is that correct?
Well, I just want to come back on something you've said there, just to correct the sort of impression there. You know, look, we have to be essentially point out here that nobody wants to disrespect unionists and loyalists in this conversation. And one way that you disrespect unionists and loyalists is not treating people like unionists and loyalists, that people believe that the United Kingdom should continue in its current form are perfectly entitled to that view, and people are perfectly entitled to organise civically in order to promote that view. Those individuals.
Oh, okay. So essentially, what you're saying, Colin, you're saying that this isn't intended to be a unionist forum, or Ireland's Future isn't intended to cater to unionists, and that's not an insult to them. That's just it's a nationalist organisation. Is that a fair thing to say?
Look, there are a range of civic initiatives happening on the island. Ireland's Future has a very discreet objective around, for example, the Citizens' Assembly, around promoting a conversation, particularly around Irish reunification. So unionists and civic unionists and loyalists are involved in conversations about, you know, in a sense, continuing with the UK as it is at the moment, or reformed and changed. And I think there's a range of initiatives going forward that have discrete objectives. I think absolutely clear and fundamental that Ireland's Future and other organisations must engage with unionism and loyalism, must reach out and have a conversation. But you have to respect people's views. And, you know, the clue to unionism is in the title. Unionists quite rightly want to see the UK continue. Mm-hmm. And unionists and loyalists will organise along those lines. So I think following on from that, you're right, you know, in a sense in which what Ireland's Future is saying and other organisations are saying is really it would be smart, prudential and wise to begin the process of prudential planning for the future.
Okay, I totally agree with you. I actually think that's really true. And one of the questions clearly that will come up there is the issue that Seamus Mallon, the former deputy leader of the SDLP, brought up. And he essentially said that 51% is not enough, that, you know, just getting one vote or a few votes over the line of a majority would not be enough. And also he raised the issue that it would not be constructive, to say the very least, to put loyalists into the position that nationalists previously were in Northern Ireland, to put loyalists into that position in a united Ireland. Would the purpose of a citizens' assembly, as you're describing it, would that be to essentially tease out every little issue in order to accommodate as best as possible everybody on the island?
I think absolutely the motivation is really around, you know, sensible planning and preparing. And you've used the phrase teasing out the issues. You know, we need nobody's calling for these referendums to happen next Wednesday. You know, nobody's calling in a sense that these referendums happen even this year or next year. Mm-hmm. What people are calling for, it seems to me, which ultimately seems to me about contingency planning and managing risks and opportunities for the future, is to begin through a citizens' assembly to talk to each other about what the future might look like on an inclusive basis, so that all feel welcome, whatever the outcome of these referendums that we think are coming, perhaps coming sooner than people anticipate. And when you've got something like this, we don't want to repeat the absolute shambolic mess of Brexit. We want to be ready on this island for those referendums when they come. We want people to know what they'll be voting for, and want it to be an informed conversation. In relation to Seamus's intervention, look, Seamus's concern come out of a, you know, perfectly legitimate anxiety and worry about the future. But I think in relation to that, we have to be guided by the Good Friday Agreement, and really the Good Friday Agreement has to frame the discussion, and the agreement's clear about what will be required mm-hmm. in order to, you know, pass this referendum. And I think an approach that really makes, you know, essentially gerrymanders the outcome, I think is ill-advised, you know, that makes you...
So setting a higher threshold, you mean?
More significant, yes, than nationalists. So I think that would be divisive. I think we stick to the Good Friday Agreement, but I'd like to underline it needs to be an inclusive, welcoming and open conversation where we tease out the options. And you know yourself at the moment, there are myriad questions that need to be answered. There are things we need to know more about.
Okay, there's one question I think you might be able to help us with, because you've obviously got an extremely eminent legal career. And one thing that I've seen in the Good Friday Agreement is that when a referendum in the North should be called, that it should be when, in the opinion of the Secretary of State, that's to say the member of the British Cabinet responsible for Northern Ireland, when in their opinion there's a reasonable chance of it passing. And you as a lawyer might be able to help me with this. Julian Smith is obviously the current Secretary of State. Am I right in thinking that the legal meaning of that is not that in Julian Smith's opinion, in the same way he might have an opinion who's going to win the 5-15 at Newmarket, it is a legally quite defined thing, the meaning of the in the opinion of the Secretary of State, and that could potentially be subject to a judicial review if the Secretary of State was seen to be irrationally coming to an opinion?
Well, I think you're absolutely right to highlight, you know, what is an intriguing aspect of this whole debate. You know, one of the things about this debate that always strikes me as interesting is that although it affects the future of this island, it accords the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, both the Good Friday Agreement and the Northern Ireland Act, mm-hmm. which is the UK legislation that frames this, an awful lot of discretion and flexibility for the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. There has been litigation in relation to this, and we're waiting the outcome of a further judicial intervention in relation to this as well. So we may know more about this soon. But at the moment, the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland has considerable discretion and flexibility when to trigger essentially a border pole for Northern Ireland, and then essentially on this island. And that's one of the reasons why I think prudential planning is so important, because the scale and extent of the Secretary of State's role, you know, no Irish government wants to find itself catapulted into these referendums without proper planning and preparation.
Because you mentioned that, and one thing I've been looking at, and I don't know if you've seen it, Michael Ashcroft is a British billionaire and donor to the Tory party who pretends to live in Belize for tax reasons, but in reality he's deeply involved in British politics. And he's so rich that he pays for his own opinion polls, and one of them was conducted in Northern Ireland. And
yep, I've seen it.
And this really quite startlingly, across Northern Ireland, at the height of the Brexit uncertainty just before Boris Johnson became Prime Minister, 51% of people wanted Northern Ireland to leave the UK and join the Republic. 49% wanted to stay in the UK. So it was the first poll ever that suggested that there was a nationalist majority. And I think that was the least interesting part of that poll. Because I think a much more interesting part of that poll is the demographic breakdown. And for over 65s, you have 62% of a unionist vote. For people 45 to 64, so middle-aged people, you have a 49%. So already, even in that older middle age group, 45 to 64, unionists are in a minority. But you go down to the 25 to 44 group, unionists are 45%. You go down to the 18 to 24 group, unionists are outnumbered 40% to 60%. And it's just obvious to me that there is a demographic freight train barreling down the line. And of course, in 10 years time, those 18 to 24 year olds will be 28 to 34, and a whole new cohort of voters who have a very large nationalist majority will be coming after them. So whatever about a 51% nationalist majority now, it's beyond question that very, very soon, literally in a 5 to 10 year timeline, there will be a clear nationalist majority. That's true, isn't it?
Look, absolutely one of the reasons why people are calling for proper management and planning and preparation by the Irish government. You know, there's a sense in which if you combine what's happened around Brexit with the likely demographic shifts over the next decade, it's clear the direction of travel. You look now in terms of unionism losing, becoming essentially a minority political position in this society over a number of elections in 2017. You know, there's a sense in which the direction of travel is clear. Now, I don't want to overemphasize demographics, you know, because obviously that doesn't necessarily lead to one particular outcome. But what it does, I think, indicate is over the next decade, with demographic change, with the option as well, you know, that Irish reunification becomes a way for the North to return to the European Union. I think people are underestimating the way in which that conversation might be framed in the future.
So you're saying young and younger unionists might say, feck this with the United Kingdom, we can go back into the EU by becoming part of the Republic of Ireland?
I think for a range of people, Northern Ireland's becoming an increasingly diverse place and pluralistic place. And to put it, what might sound quite crudely, in the longer term, Ireland might simply look like the more attractive and better bet for many people, including young people in this society, people who want to enjoy the advantages of, if you like, full-fat European Union membership, rather than the sort of special arrangement that's been agreed as part of the withdrawal agreement. Now, I may be wrong in that, but my sense would be that combine that with a demographic shift, and I think it would be unwise for any Irish government not to start the process of prudential planning. And that's why Ireland's future, and other groups as well, and other people on the island, are calling for a citizens' assembly, a forum in which, as you used the phrase earlier, you know, tease out options. We need to tease out options in an inclusive way, in a welcoming way. You're absolutely right to emphasise the importance of engagement with unionism, civic unionism in the North, to make sure people get to feed into that process, that it's co-designed, co-authored, and people feel welcome to that conversation. And ultimately, for me,
hold on for a second there, because I know that you're a professor of law and you're interested in those legalistic things, but people will be interested in the nuts and bolts reality of that. And I think it's a very good idea, and I think it's very important that we would have that. But what about the outcomes? Have you given any thought to the outcomes? Because it seems to me that what would most likely be the case is that people would want what is likely to be the most expensive, and certainly the best services. So, for example, you have the access to the NHS in Northern Ireland. In the South, you have essentially free or largely free third level education, certainly costing a lot less. Won't it be likely to be the case that people will default to saying that they want the most expensive version of everything?
We need to tease out all the options, as you underline, including the economic options, including what it means for healthcare on the island of Ireland, mm-hmm. and access to healthcare and what people expect, for example, in relation to the North End and the All Ireland scenario. The work on that, is beginning to happen. People like Seamus McGuinness in the ESRI, people actually up here like Paul Gosling, who's beginning to look at the sort of economic implications of all that. But again, as you've underlined, we need the Citizens' Assembly, we need the institutional forum where we can get people together to tease that all out in an informed and evidence-based way as well. Because as you know, there's an awful lot of myth on the island, there's an awful lot of anecdote, and I think what we need is evidence. And I think that's where an assembly, a forum to tease this out would be very, very helpful indeed. I think the civic conversation will continue. People like myself will continue to do our own research and work teasing that out. But I think it's time really for the Irish government, or the next Irish government, I should say, mm-hmm. to step up to the plate on all this. So.
Okay. And one last thing. It's entirely possible that large sections of people who now identify as unionists will move towards, if not welcoming it, at least being amenable or being resisting not very strongly joining the Republic. But it is beyond question that a large tranche of them won't. And, you're from Northern Ireland and you know what it was like in the 1980s, well into the 1990s. At that time, Sinn Féin was only getting 10% of the vote in the North. But that 10%, and if they represented 10% of the population, that 10% of the population essentially managed to cause mayhem. If only one unionist out of five was that militant in resisting a united Ireland, that would be an almost impossible situation for a government from Dublin, however far its writ ran. And Dublin doesn't have the deep pockets that London had, or the army that was required to keep the place even vaguely peaceful. We could be setting ourselves up for a very, going back to a tragic situation, couldn't we?
Well, that's precisely why it needs wise, sensible and prudential planning and management now. On the island. That's why Ireland's Future and others are calling for preparation and planning. I think also to underline the importance of, the Good Friday Agreement is quite clear that conversations are taken forward in a peaceful and democratic way only. And I think that has to frame this discussion too. That's also why it needs to be an inclusive, welcome and open conversation, that people feel free to share their views on this. But also want to underline something else. A lot of focus in our conversation, obviously enough, on mm-hmm. Ireland's future and Irish reunification. But I think this is a big challenge. And I think it's a big challenge in particular for unionism, because unionism needs to come up with a proposition around why people should remain within the United Kingdom, given the changing context in Northern Ireland. So it's not just about persuading people in terms of Irish reunification. Obviously, Ireland's future, that's where that focus will rest. I think this is a major challenge for unionism. How is unionism going to develop an inclusive proposition for why remaining within the United Kingdom is the best option, given Brexit and all the things we've talked about today? So I think the focus shouldn't only be on Ireland's future. The focus should now really turn to unionism to say, well, what is the proposition to everyone living in this region, if you like, the North, that remaining in the UK is the best option. And I think we'll be better off in the north and on this island if we have that healthy debate, because really we've had 100 years of avoiding each other in the island, and we need to start talking to each other in grown-up ways about where this island may be going next.
Colin Harvey, Professor of Human Rights Law at the School of Law in Queen's University Belfast, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you very much.
Here's How is Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast. Make your view heard. Record a contribution to be included in the next show. Just dial 076 603 5060 and tell the world what you're thinking. Your voicemail may be included in the next podcast. You can find tips on recording your contribution and other ways to contact the show at hereshow.ie/call.
Go to the website for sources and references from the show, and while you're there, you can like the show on Facebook, follow the show on Twitter at Here's How Podcast, and get in touch with me if you can suggest a guest or a topic for a future show. And thanks again to all the patrons on Patreon. They allow me to devote more time to research and finding interesting guests. And if you could do the same as them and donate a dollar or two per podcast or per month, go to patreon.com/hereshow. That link is on the website. Also there you can find out how to subscribe to the podcast for free on your computer, on your phone or by email. All that information is at www.hereshow.ie. The Here's How podcast is produced and presented by me, William Campbell. Thank you for listening.